I'm Stephen Petro. Right now, this show is made possible by my friends at PRI, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, and me. If you'd like to sponsor the show, we can talk. But for now, you can help by spreading the word. Share this episode, subscribe. And hey, if you've got something nice to say, write a review in iTunes. Here we go. Welcome to The Civilist from WUNC and PRI. We'll discuss today's tough political and social issues in a new way with kindness and respect. I'm your host, Stephen Petro, here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today, I give you my take on my governor, Pat McCrory, and the rules of etiquette he cites in wanting to keep transgender people from using the restroom that matches their gender identity.
All of a sudden, through political correctness, we're throwing away basic etiquette.
Then my guest experts help answer your questions in our new Rules for Better Behavior segment. First, we hear from a mother of two who really doesn't want to have a third kid, but her husband sure does.
If this woman doesn't want to have the baby, that's the end of the discussion. No baby.
The guy has no rights? The guy has no rights?
Well...
And two men agree to an open relationship. Now one is breaking the rules by falling in love. These quandaries and more coming up. Now it's time for my take on a hot-button issue of the day. Its title, An Etiquette Lesson for North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory. You see, I just returned from a quick trip to the restroom. No worries here. But for my transgender friends here in the Tar Heel State, there is a problem you've undoubtedly heard about. That's the state's anti-trans bathroom legislation, also known as House Bill 2. It's actually illegal to use a public bathroom that doesn't match the sex listed on your birth certificate. This remains true despite a federal ruling in late August that prohibited the University of North Carolina from enforcing the law, but only for the three plaintiffs who challenged its constitutionality. So what's it like for trans people to use public restrooms? I turned to James Parker Sheffield, a transgender man who spoke with me from his home in Atlanta. First, I asked him to describe himself.
You know, I would describe myself as an incredibly average guy. A little bit of a hillbilly look going with the beard and the occasion to wear camouflage even when I'm not going into the woods.
I asked about which restroom he'd use on a visit to the Tar Heel State.
You know, to be honest, I probably will try not to visit North Carolina. There's no way I can go into a women's room. There's just no way. My safety would really be in danger there, especially when you see even high-profile people posting things like, you know, I would carry a gun into Target. That's the kind of stuff that we're afraid of. If I walk into a women's room, no one is immediately going to assume that I am trans. So their response to that and why they may think that I may be in the women's room is a threat to my safety. So it's just not something that I could do, even if it meant going into the men's room and potentially being clocked as trans and potentially getting in some sort of legal trouble.
James isn't the only one avoiding North Carolina because of HB 2. The state has lost hundreds of millions of dollars in business. Bruce Springsteen and other stars have canceled concerts, and the NCAA moved the All-Star Game out of state. But the supporters of the anti-trans law remain steadfast. And that's their right, of course. In this supercharged debate, I've been most surprised by Governor McCrory's citing of what he calls basic etiquette as his defense of North Carolina's discriminatory law. Soon after the bill's signing, McCrory told NBC News,
"You know, we all have to make adjustments in life, and we've had these proper etiquette situations for decades in our country, and all of a sudden, through political correctness, we're throwing away basic etiquette."
Some in the media call me Mr. Manners, but I've never heard of any such etiquette rules. So I turned to my collection of about 200 manners books. And here's what I found. The late, great Amy Vanderbilt did mention bathrooms and etiquette in her Big Book of Manners. But she only covered the issue of care of by a weekend guest, with her suggestion, leave it as you found it or better, and gift suggestions for that included bath salts and bath mitts, if they're not from the bargain counter in a drugstore. Emily Post just mentions restrooms when it comes to tipping attendants and excusing self to visit. Perhaps online manners experts would have more to say about all this, I thought to myself. and a quick search took me to a page for the International Center for Bathroom Etiquette. Yep, that's the title. And I did smile when I read their tagline, performing number one and number two in comfort and style since 1995. Some of the topics on this website include talking on your cell phone in a public restroom, masturbating in the bathroom, and naturally, guys, seat up, seat down. Okay, note taken. Alas for the governor, I found nothing to back up his assertion. If asked, I'd actually have advised him to consider this dictum from Emily Post. Consideration for the rights and feelings of others is not merely a rule for behavior in public, but it's the very foundation upon which social life is built. A few days after the federal judge prohibited UNC from enforcing the bathroom provision of HB 2, I spoke with Brennan Lewis, a sophomore at Chapel Hill, who uses gender-neutral pronouns. They also identify as genderqueer, so neither male nor female. Brennan explained to me how they've been repeatedly harassed, especially when it came to bathrooms. They said they generally felt safer in the women's room, but barely.
I would walk in, and I had short hair in high school, and I wear men's clothes, and I have for a long time. I would go in, and people would just stare at me. Some of the younger folks would say things directly to me, be like, oh, are you a boy or a girl? Like, what are you doing here? Sometimes I'd walk into a bathroom, and behind my back, people would be like, oh, that's a boy, or they'd be laughing, or they would be like, that's a lesbian.
How did it make you feel beyond uncomfortable?
I felt, I would say degraded in a way. I felt like people didn't recognize me as a person in that instance. When I'm walking into a bathroom, they're like, oh, there's this like thing that's walking in, you know? Like people called me it sometimes, and that was just really humiliating.
Wow. No one should be treated that way. And if Governor McCrory is going to cite basic etiquette as his rationale, I wish he'd consider Mrs. Post's timeless prescriptions for kindness and consideration. This is The Civilist. I'm Stephen Petro. Now it's time for new rules for better behavior. That's when I pick some of your questions about all those tricky social situations, run them by my friends, and then tell you what to do, when, and why. Each of my guest experts today can be heard on public radio. Joshua Johnson has hosted Truth Be Told, a podcast about race and culture, diversity and connection. He's at KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And Anne Strainchamps hosts Wisconsin Public Radio's wonderful program, To the Best of Our Knowledge. Her show is really a radio dinner party about the big ideas challenging all of us today. Hey, Anne, thank you for being here.
Hey, Stephen, thanks for having me.
To get us started, I'd like us to get to know each other a little bit better. So, Anne, I read on the website that you have a chocolate obsession of some sort. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, it's waned in recent years. Maybe I've just gotten older and started liking butterscotch better. But yeah, I used to hand dip chocolates. I had this little tiny business with an old college friend, and we made chocolate truffles and sold them at a local farmer's market and in some local restaurants.
Chocolate versus butterscotch. I would have to go butterscotch.
Well, maybe I just dipped too much chocolate. I mean, I have very fond memories of, you know, it would be 2 a.m. and we would be up and we'd be exhausted and there would be trays of 500 chocolate truffles around us and we would be covered in chocolate, and you just kind of lose your taste for it after a while.
I'm imagining a Lucy episode, but we'll put that aside.
I know
for
exactly
now.
The one you mean, and yes, it was close.
Like Lucy and Ethel in a sweatshop.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
So, Joshua, tell us something else that's not in your bio.
Well, I don't think it's in my bio, but I am an avid weightlifter. I spend more than a few hours in the gym, as anyone who's ever met me in person can attest. I love the reaction on people's faces when they actually meet me and realize that I'm not like this little Robert Siegel lookalike that they expected, but that I am like a big, tall black guy with biceps and a mohawk. And they realize that this image they've built in their brain is wrong. and the look on their face is usually pretty priceless.
Don't you love that about radio?
Onward. Our first listener question this week weighs whether there can be too much of a good thing. That is, when it comes to kids.
My husband and I have two wonderful girls, ages 12 and 10. He has been asking recently for us to have a third child. Our closest friends just had the third child, and we see how happy they are, how much joy the baby brings to the family. With me recently being laid off, it would be actually the perfect time to do this. But with two kids that are now very self-sufficient, I can't imagine being pregnant again, waking up all hours of the night, dealing with colic, diapers, etc. He's a wonderful husband and father. I feel very guilty saying no, but the selfish side of me just can't muster the strength to do this. Plus, I think about the family dynamic, how it changes, and what it would mean for my two girls, one of them being the middle child and developing all of the syndromes that go along with that title. Would I still be a good mother to the older two with the needy new baby in the house and love them equally? I'm just not so sure. We'll love to hear your thoughts on the subject.
So whether to have another baby, and since you are the parent in this group of three, I think you have two kids who are almost grown up, what do you think about this situation?
This is a hard one for me not to take personally, because yes, I have two kids who are also 2 years apart, and the youngest is just about to leave for college. I have to tell you, I am really enjoying this new stage of my life. I've got more time for career directions, for my husband, for travel. So, you know, but this isn't about me. This is about the listener, right? So what I hear, a couple of things that just worry me a little bit. What I hear is a lot of her talking about what her husband wants and what might be good for her kids, not as much about what she really wants. So I'd say the first thing, get clear about what you really want. Like, it is okay to not want a third child. The other thing is, if her youngest child is 10 years old, she's not just going to have a third child, she's going to have an only child for a good part of that child's life. So how does she feel about having an only child? And the third thing, and then I'll shut up, the third thing is, you know, ideally this would be a mutual decision that she and her husband would make. And I wonder from what she says if perhaps they're polarizing the discussion a bit, if maybe she's articulating all of the no and all of the hesitation and he's articulating all of the yes, this would be great. And if they could talk together and kind of break that down a little bit so that ideally they're both owning some of the ambivalence, I think they might be closer to being able to make a decision mutually.
I think those are really good set of points. And you know what struck me also in this question, Anne, is the questioner often knows what the answer is. And so I heard her say, I can't imagine being pregnant again. And then there are all these sort of other considerations about that. So I always think it's important to listen to your own voice in weighty matters like this. Joshua, what do you think?
Well, I take Anne's points to heart. I think she makes a lot of good points. Ultimately, if this woman doesn't want to have the baby, that's the end of the discussion. No baby. Like, that's it. I mean, the father's investment in this transaction.
The guy has no rights? The guy has no rights?
Well, let's put it like this. The man plants the seed, but the woman has to tend the harvest all year long. So, like, she's the one who's got to man the investment this whole time, and she has the veto as far as I'm concerned.
It wouldn't have to be that way, but
for her, I mean, if she's the one who's going to have to bear the child, personally, I would give her the veto. If she says, I can't imagine being pregnant again, at the end of the day, that could kind of be the deal breaker. However, I think there's another option that they may not have considered, which is adoption. If they want to have another child in the family, maybe they consider fostering a child or becoming an adoptive family if the idea is to have a child rather than to have a baby. Or they could maybe even foster a baby that's been abandoned.
Great points, Joshua. Anne, did you want to chime in?
I was going to say, so there are two points. The first one is to have a baby or not to have a baby. And I love Joshua's idea about adoption. That's just a really good point. But the other thing is, really what I hear in her question is, this is about her relationship with her husband. Like, yeah, she can say, you know what, veto, I can't do this, but she still has to live with him and they have to feel good about each other. She doesn't want to live with a husband who feels resentful because she said no to something he really wanted. So that's what I was trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's all good advice. The other thing that struck me was at the end of her question, she was worrying about whether she'd be able to love them equally.
And it reminded me of the two Cocker Spaniels that I have had. And the first one I got in my mid-20s, and that dog had my heart forever. And after she died, I debated for a long time whether I would get another dog, and I wound up doing so. But I was really afraid of whether I could love another Cocker Spaniel equally. And it turned out that I loved the second dog completely differently, but totally. And that was really important life lesson for me with that. Not to take lessons from four-leggeds to two-leggeds. That doesn't always work, but...
Love just exponentially expands. There aren't limits.
Now let's move on to a new question, and this one is about trouble in paradise.
I'm a college student, and I've been seeing this guy for about 3 months. He's a foreign exchange student, so he will only be here for about 3 more months. About a month and a half into it, we talked and agreed that since he'll be going back home, it'll be best to keep this casual. We agreed that we would keep dating, but that we could have sex with other people if we wanted. So pretty much an open relationship. Now 2 months later, I have developed stronger feelings for him, and I don't want to sleep with other people. And I get jealous when I think he might be with someone else. So my question is, am I wrong for wanting him to be exclusively with me since we already agreed to keep this casual? And since I know this will all end in a few months anyway, am I just overcomplicating the whole situation? Should I tell him how I feel, or should I just ride it out and enjoy the next few months?
Well, I'll tell you, my heart kind of breaks for this fellow because I was in that situation about 15 years ago, and I was living in San Francisco. So, you know, and he lived in New York, and I thought there was an expiration date on it too, and we made all sorts of understandings, and, you know, they all blew up in our face. I wound up moving to New York, and we lived happily ever after for quite some time. So I'm not sure how I feel about this question. Anne, do you want to take the first stab at this?
Well, I guess the first thing I usually do in dilemmas like that is turn it around. So if you were in the other guy's position, would you want to know that this guy has stronger feelings for you than he expected? And I'd say yes, absolutely. And also, what's the worst that could happen? You tell him and he says, oh, I don't feel that way. Okay, well, you're gonna have some loss no matter what. Either he's going to move or he's going to say, gee, I don't feel that way. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You might as well take a risk on love.
Take a risk on love. Joshua, what do you think the caller should do?
Well, I have actually been in a very, very similar situation to this myself. And it was while I was a college student. And it was with a guy who I knew I was only going to see over the summer. And we had to make this decision of what to do. It ended tragically because his homophobic parents ripped us apart before we could say goodbye. Buy me a few drinks and I'll tell you that story one day. But I think key to this open relationship is the word open. Communication is the key to all relationships. You can't have a relationship, open, closed, or otherwise, if you don't communicate. The minute he said, I'm a college student, I'm like, okay, no, you need to let this guy go. You need to allow this guy to go and to live his life. He's a student. You're a student. This is not necessarily built to last. And if it's not, that's fine. You're students. Like, you're early in your life. I question the premise at the end of his story where he says, I know this will all end in a few months anyway. You know what? Life is long. You might be surprised how long this person is actually in your life. Maybe not as a partner or as a friend with benefits, but as a friend. Like, this is one of your early relationships. So you are building a bond that, because, you know, the world is so much smaller than it used to be, this person may be in your life in a very valuable place for quite some time. So you owe this person honesty. No, you're not wrong for wanting him to be exclusive with you. Your feelings are what they are. Mm-hmm. I would not be so sure it will end in a few months necessarily. I mean, life may surprise you. Yes, you should absolutely tell him how you feel. You owe him honesty.
Yes,
He owes you honesty. And if this is a relationship at all, your jealousy is invalidated by your silence.
Okay.
You can't be jealous of something you won't be honest about.
I love that, Joshua. I think my last word on this would be, don't future trip. And what I mean by that is, don't try to plan out everything. Make the decisions you need to make for today, which I would say is also being open and honest, and go from there. So our last question is about maintaining long-distance relationships with family.
Hi, Stephen. I live about 10 hours away from my family in my hometown, and I haven't been home in a few months, so I'm planning an upcoming trip. But I'm having a hard time figuring out when to go. There are 3 events coming up over the course of 1 month. There's a big family reunion. My dad is graduating from a trade program that he's been going through for a long time. And my baby brother's turning 18. I'd like to go to everything, but that's a lot of time off and flights are expensive. Do I pick an event? And if so, how do I decide which? And how do I explain why I can't make it for these other milestones?
So what really stood out to me in this question is, I'd like to go to everything. So guess what, people? You can't go to everything. And this is a great example of having to start to learn to make choices, set your priorities. So Anne, which event should this listener go to?
Well, I would choose intimacy over the big thing. So I would immediately say no to the big family reunion because it's going to be a whole lot of people. So the father and the brother are both much closer relationships. So I would pick one of those. And I'm a big believer in have your cake and eat it too. So I wonder if she couldn't go for her father's celebration and then consider asking her baby brother to come visit her. He's 18 years old. Maybe this could be a birthday present, or maybe she and her brother could each drive 5 hours and meet someplace halfway. If money's an issue, they could go camping. It's summertime.
Joshua, how should she explain why she's missing the other 2 gatherings, if that's what happens?
Sorry, guys, I can't make it.
You're,
see how easy that was?
You are harsh.
Look, I can't make. I'm 10 hours away. Look, my family lives in South Florida, in Palm Beach County. I live in San Francisco. It's 2,800 miles. You know how much a flight is for the holidays? It's like $700. My partner and I can't do that. We're like, look, we'll see you on January 7th. We're flying after the holidays. Because practicality, just at a certain point for me, and maybe I'm just harsh, but practicality has to come into play. I do take Anne's point about picking one event to have a presence at. I actually looked at it the other way. I think the key for these 3 is not so much attendance, but presence. You want people to know that you've acknowledged this milestone and that your presence is felt. So maybe, for instance, she attends the family reunion because her dad and her baby brother might be there. So at the reunion, she brings a present for dad for graduation. She brings a present for baby brother for his 18th birthday. And so now she has a presence at all 3 of those milestones without actually having to attend.
Okay.
Well, I have to say, this is family. So I don't understand why she can't just say to her family, pick up the phone, call them and say, hey, I have limited time and not that much money and I can't get that much time off from work. So what matters most to you guys?
Well, and I would say the answer to that is because it is family. Families can be sometimes the most difficult people to talk to. And I'll just end this by saying I remain forever in the doghouse with one friend. Years ago, I was invited to 2 weddings. I chose one over the other, and the second friend never forgave me. So there will be ramifications, but I hope not to you, Joshua, when you stay back in San Francisco.
You know, that's why God invented Skype.
Exactly. Thank you both for your insights today.
Thanks, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Anne Strainchamps is the host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. And Joshua Johnson is the host of Truth Be Told. He's at KQED in San Francisco. Both shows are PRI productions. We'd love to hear your questions about how to navigate tricky social situations. Please send a voice memo with your message to the syphilispodcast@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 919-263-0929. We promise you will be anonymous. That's all for this episode. Next time, a cancer survivor tells us the best way to come out about a serious illness, and Joshua and Anne take more of your questions. The Syphilis Podcast is a production of WUNC, PRI, and me. My producer is Rebecca Martinez. Mark Blasco wrote our theme song. Other music came from the Sony Aventorum Wind Quintet. I'm Stephen Petro. Thanks for listening. Do you have a friend who should hear this show? Please feel free to share it, encourage them to subscribe, or even write an iTunes review. It would mean a lot.